I want to start today with a blast from the past. Have you ever heard of the Delia effect?
The Delia effect. Wow, that takes me back. We're talking about the British cook Delia Smith, right?
The legend herself. So picture this. It's the 90s. Delia goes on television. She's holding up a specific frying pan, or I don't know if she uses cranberries in a sauce. What happens next?
If I recall correctly, chaos ensues.
Absolute chaos.
Yeah.
Overnight, whatever she mentioned would just sell out across the entire country. There was an incident where she used white eggs in a recipe,
White eggs specifically.
specifically white ones, not brown, and national sales of white eggs jumped by 10%. It caused a literal supply chain shortage because one person on TV said, use this.
It really demonstrates the power of influence, doesn't it? But I'm guessing we aren't doing a deep dive into 1990s television trivia today.
Not exactly, no. I bring it up because it's the perfect illustration of a hidden superpower. We tend to think of chefs as people who just make our dinner, but the Delia effect proves they're actually gatekeepers. They decide what people buy, what farmers grow, and, essentially what the entire food system looks like.
That is a massive amount of leverage.
It is. But today, we aren't talking about the celebrities. We're going to talk about the little guys.
The pub down the street.
The pub down the street. The family-run bistro. The caterer who does your office lunch. And we're basing this on a fascinating report titled Low Carbon Menus: Tools and Tactics to Empower SME Chefs by Andrea Zick and Amy Fetzer.
And this report is genuinely eye-opening because it frames these local chefs not just as business owners, but as unrecognized climate superheroes.
I love that term.
The premise is that if you can give these chefs the right tools, they can change the food system from the bottom up.
So the mission today is to find out how.
Yeah.
How does the guy flipping burgers at the local bar save the planet? But first, we have to deal with an acronym, SME.
Right. Small to medium enterprise.
It sounds so dry. It sounds like something you talk about in a tax seminar.
It does lack a certain glamour. But in the context of the UK hospitality sector, an SME is just any business with fewer than 250 employees. And here's the statistic that floored me. SMEs make up 99% of the 135,000 catering enterprises in the UK.
99%.
Yes, 99%.
So when we talk about the food industry, we picture McDonald's or Starbucks or these
Expensive
massive,
conglomerates, right?
exactly, these massive conglomerates. But you're saying the industry is actually a swarm of small businesses.
Precisely. They are the absolute backbone of the food world. But because they're small individually, they get ignored. Research funding, government policy, big sustainability initiatives, they all target the giants. The little guys are flying under the radar.
Which seems like a huge strategic mistake if they control 99% of the market. But let's look at the actual climate impact here. We know food is a big deal for the environment, but give us the numbers.
Food accounts for roughly 38% of the UK's national emissions.
Over a third. Wow, that more than transport?
It's comparable, and in some ways, it's more complex. And this is where we have to debunk a major myth. If I ask you to lower the carbon footprint of a restaurant, what's the first thing you'd do?
I'd probably change the light bulbs to LEDs. Maybe get a more efficient refrigerator. Turn down the heating in the winter.
That is exactly what most people think. They look at the energy bill. But the report highlights that for a hospitality business, the real monster is scope three emissions.
Okay, let's pause on scope three.
Yeah.
I hear this term thrown around in climate tech, but break it down for us.
Think of it like this. Scope one and two are the emissions you create directly, like the gas burning on your stove or the electricity running your lights.
Obvious stuff.
The obvious stuff. Scope three is everything else in your supply chain. It's the emissions caused by growing the cow, feeding the cow, trucking the meat to the warehouse, all of it.
So it's the backpack of pollution that the ingredients arrive with.
That's a great way to put it. And here's the kicker. Food and beverage purchases contribute between 62 and 73% of a hospitality business's total footprint.
Wow. So I can turn off all the lights, I can insulate the walls, I can recycle my cardboard. But if I'm buying high carbon food, I'm barely scratching the surface.
You're rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. The problem isn't the oven, it's what you put in the oven.
Okay, so we've established the stakes.
Yeah.
We have this army of SME chefs who are buying the ingredients that are driving climate change. They are the gatekeepers. So the obvious question is,
Yeah.
why don't they just fix it? Why isn't every menu already low carbon?
You might assume it's because they're not interested. But the research shows the opposite. Most of these chefs care deeply about quality and provenance.
Right.
They want to be sustainable. It aligns with their values. But they are running into what the report calls the permission gap.
The permission gap. That sounds like corporate speak for my boss won't let me.
It's not far off. Yeah. We have this romantic image of the head chef as the dictator of the kitchen, right?
Yeah.
The Gordon Ramsay figure who screams and gets whatever he wants.
It's my kitchen, my rules.
Exactly. But in reality, especially in these smaller businesses or pub chains, the chef is often just seen as a technician. They cook. They don't decide. The real power over what gets bought lies with the procurement team or the general manager or the owner who is looking exclusively at the profit margin.
So the chef might say, I want to serve this amazing local regeneratively farmed pork. And the procurement guy just looks at a spreadsheet and says, nope, we have a contract with this massive supplier. Stick to the plan.
Correct. Psychologists call it a lack of perceived behavioral control. If you don't feel like you have the authority to change things, you stop trying. You just cook what you're told.
That is incredibly demoralizing. It's like being a painter, but someone else chooses your colors.
And that leads directly to the second barrier, the knowledge gap. Even if they did have permission, most chefs are flying blind.
Right, because a carrot doesn't come with a nutrition label for carbon.
Exactly. You walk into a walk-in fridge, you see boxes of produce. You have no idea that the cheese on the left might have 10 times the carbon footprint of the chicken on the right. There's just no data at the point of decision.
So they're guessing.
They're guessing. And because they don't have the data, sustainability gets treated as a side dish.
I love that phrase. Sustainability is a side dish.
It's the perfect metaphor. It becomes this extra thing you have to worry about, like scrubbing the floors, rather than being baked into the core quality of the meal.
And if it's not essential to the dish, it gets dropped when things get busy.
And kitchens always get busy. Which brings us to the training issue. I imagine teaching chefs about carbon footprints isn't easy when they're working 12-hour shifts.
Have you ever been in a commercial kitchen during a Friday night rush?
I've seen enough reality TV to know it looks like a war zone.
It is. It's hot, it's loud, it's high pressure. Now, imagine trying to pull those chefs out of that environment to sit in a quiet classroom for 2 hours to watch a PowerPoint on greenhouse gases.
They would fall asleep.
Or just be checking their phones, worrying about prep.
It completely fails. Traditional training methods just do not work for people who think with their hands and move at a million miles an hour. Plus, the staff turnover in hospitality is notorious.
Right.
You invest in training someone, and 3 months later, they move to a different restaurant. The knowledge just walks out the door.
So the system is broken. The chefs don't have the power. They don't have the data. And the training is boring and incompatible with their lives. A bit of a mess.
It is a mess, but this is where the report pivots from here's why everything is terrible to here's the toolkit for action. And I have to say, some of these solutions are incredibly clever.
Let's get into the toolkit. How do we empower these chefs?
The first tool is my favorite because it costs almost nothing. It's called menu architecture.
Menu architecture. That sounds very grand. Is that just menu design?
It is, but it's backed by behavioral science. It's about how the physical layout and language of a menu dictates what we choose. Let's talk about placement. Eye tracking studies show that when you look at a menu, your eyes are drawn to specific hot spots, usually the top right corner or the first and last items in a list. This is prime real estate.
The golden triangle of the menu.
Yes. So traditionally, what do restaurants put there?
Probably the steak.
Mm.
Or the most expensive special.
Right. But if you put your plant-rich, low-carbon dish in that hot spot, sales for that item statistically go up. You aren't forcing anyone to order it. You're just putting it where they are already looking.
That's a classic nudge.
Yeah.
But let's talk about naming, because this one feels a bit, well, controversial. The report mentions that calling something a vegetable stew is the kiss of death.
Vegetable stew sounds like something you eat in a Dickensian orphanage. It sounds punitive. It focuses on what is missing, the meat.
So what's the fix? Do you lie?
No, you don't lie. You market. You use evocative sensory language. Instead of vegetable stew, you call it hearty Provencal bean stew with crusty bread.
Okay, I admit my mouth watered a little bit at crusty bread.
See, you focus on the provenance, the texture, the flavor. There was a study where simply changing the names of vegetable dishes increased sales by 25%.
25% just by changing the words?
Just the words.
But let me play devil's advocate here.
Mm-hmm.
Is there an ethical line? Are we manipulating people? If I'm a diehard carnivore, am I being tricked into eating beans?
I think that's a valid question, but consider the alternative. Menus have always been manipulated to sell the highest margin items, which are usually steak or alcohol.
That's true.
This is just using the same psychological tools for a different outcome. You're not hiding the ingredients, you're just making the sustainable choice look as appealing as it actually is.
That's a fair point. We're just leveling the playing field against the steak.
Yeah.
What else is in the toolkit? You said the training was a disaster. How do we fix that?
You have to embrace operational bite sizes.
Bite size.
Instead of the 2-hour seminar, you do a 5-minute briefing. You do it during prep time while everyone is chopping onions. You say, okay, team, today we're focusing on food waste in the garnish station. You integrate it into the workflow.
Catch them while they're captive, but make it quick.
And you use section champions, peer-to-peer learning. You nominate one line cook to be the waste warrior or whatever you want to call it. It's much more effective when your buddy on the line tells you to watch the bin rather than a manager holding a clipboard.
Okay, so we've hacked the menu and we've hacked the training, but we still have that flying blind problem. The data. You said it's too hard to measure everything.
It is. A small pub doesn't have the time to calculate the carbon footprint of every pinch of salt. So the report suggests the big hitter strategy.
The 80-20 rule.
Exactly. Or in this case, the big five. The report advises chefs to use default factors. Just assume that 5 ingredients, beef, lamb, poultry, crustaceans, and cheese, are your problem areas.
Just those 5.
Focus exclusively on those. Ignore the vegetables, the grains, the spices. If you can reduce or swap out those 5, you solve most of the problem.
It simplifies the game. Yeah. You don't need a PhD in climate science. You just need to watch the beef.
And to prove this, I want to walk you through the case study in the report. This is where the rubber meets the road. They didn't just theorize. They ran a pilot with a fine dining SME for over a year.
Okay, hit me with the numbers.
They tracked 6,282 purchase lines, every single thing that came through the door, and they tracked food waste for 52 weeks.
That is a lot of data for a small business. What was the headline?
The first number that jumps out is the average emissions per diner. It was 7.3 kilograms of CO2 equivalent per meal.
7.3 kilograms. Is that bad? I don't have a reference point for that.
Let me give you one. The Eat Well Guide, which is the UK government's recommendation for a sustainable, healthy diet, suggests a carbon budget of roughly 4.1 to 5.8 kilograms for an entire day.
Whoa. Stop there for a second. So if I go out for dinner at this place, in one meal, I have blown through nearly double my carbon allowance for the whole day.
Correct. It really highlights how carbon intensive the current dining model is. But when they drilled into why it was so high, they found something shocking about the beef.
The big hitter.
Beef accounted for 31% of the total emissions of the restaurant. A huge chunk. But guess what percentage of the total volume of food purchased was beef?
I assume it was a lot. A steakhouse vibe, maybe. 30%.
5%.
Wait, 5%?
It's 5%.
That's barely anything. That's a garnish. That's a specialized ingredient. How can 5% of the food cause a third of the pollution?
That is the disproportionate impact of ruminant meat. It punches so far above its weight class in terms of damage. But this is actually good news for the chef.
How is that good news?
Because it means you don't have to overhaul your entire menu. You don't have to become a vegan restaurant. You just need to look at that tiny 5% of your inventory. Maybe you make the steak portion smaller. Maybe you swap one beef dish for a pork dish.
Or do a blend burger that's half mushroom.
Exactly. You can make a massive dent in that 7.3 kilogram figure without changing 95% of what you buy.
That's a powerful insight. You target the anomaly. What about the waste? You said they tracked that too.
They did. And the restaurant was actually very well run. Their food waste was only 1.7% by weight. In the industry, that is incredibly lean.
So they shouldn't worry about it.
You would think so. But here's the twist. Because their menu relied on those high-carbon ingredients, the beef, the lamb, the cheese, even that tiny amount of waste was the fourth largest source of emissions for the whole business.
Even though it was basically scraps.
Yes. The report uses that term carbon backpack, which we touched on earlier. Think about it. If you throw away a burger, you aren't just throwing away meat. You are throwing away the 15,000 liters of water it took to grow the feed, the diesel for the tractor, the methane, the cow burped, the refrigeration truck, the plastic packaging.
And it all ends up in the bin.
It all ends up in the bin. That 1 kilogram of food waste represents more than 3 kilograms of greenhouse gases released for absolutely no reason.
That image of the carbon backpack is going to stick with me. Every time I scrape a plate, I'm not just tossing food, I'm tossing all that energy.
It's sobering.
So we have the tools: menu architecture, bite-sized training, focusing on the big five. But there is one more concept in the report that sounds a bit academic. Theory U.
Yeah, yes. Theory U. It sounds like a hipster band, doesn't it?
It really does. Or a module in a philosophy degree. Why is this in a report for chefs?
It's actually a change management framework developed at MIT, and it's crucial because it addresses the mindset.
Okay, visualize it for us. Why is it a U?
Think of the shape of the letter U. The left side going down is about stopping. In a kitchen, everything is reactive. Order comes in, fire it, plate it, go.
Right.
Theory U says you have to stop downloading old habits. You have to go down to the bottom of the U.
The bottom is reflection.
Presencing,
Yeah.
sensing. It's pausing to actually look at the system. The report describes workshops where chefs stopped cooking and just looked at their high-carbon dishes. They asked, "What is this dish trying to be? How can we create the same satisfaction with 30% less carbon?"
That feels very un-kitchen-like.
Yeah.
Pausing is usually a sin in hospitality.
It is, which is why it's hard. But when they did it, when they came up the right side of the U, which is prototyping, amazing things happened.
Like what?
They found that the co-created low-carbon dishes often had higher profit margins.
Because meat is expensive.
Exactly. And the chefs felt more ownership because they invented it. It wasn't a rule imposed from above, it was a creative challenge they solved. It turned the permission gap into a creative opportunity.
So it solves the psychological barrier. You aren't taking away their toys, you're giving them a new game to play.
That's it. And that is how you unlock the superhero potential of the SME chef.
This has been such a journey. I honestly haven't looked at a menu the same way since reading this. I used to just look for the cheapest thing or the hungriest thing. Now I'm looking for the nudges.
Once you see the matrix of menu architecture, you can't unsee it.
You really can't. So let's wrap this up. We've learned that the little guys are actually the biggest player in the UK food scene. We've learned that chefs are blocked by a lack of permission and data, but that simple hacks like renaming a stew or moving it to the top right corner can have huge impacts.
And we've learned that you don't need to be perfect. You just need to watch the big five ingredients and understand the carbon backpack of your waste.
So for the listener who isn't running a bistro, what's the takeaway? Why should they care about SME procurement?
Because you are the target of the architecture. Next time you go out, look at the menu. See if you can spot the hot spots. Ask yourself, am I ordering this because I want it or because the menu design led me here?
Be a conscious consumer.
And vote with your wallet. Order the hearty Provençal stew. Prove to the chef that the sustainable option sells. If it sells, the procurement team will allow them to buy more of it. You help close the permission gap.
I love that. We are part of the system too.
We are.
I want to leave everyone with a thought that connects back to that Delia effect. We talk about how Delia Smith could change the nation's egg buying habits just by mentioning a recipe on TV.
The power of the nudge.
Exactly. If a chef can cut their carbon footprint in half just by renaming a dish or moving it 2 inches to the right on a piece of paper, it makes you wonder, where else in our own lives, in our offices, our homes, our communities, are we just one small nudge away from a massive impact? What's the menu architecture of your daily life?
That is a fascinating question to chew on.
Thanks for diving in with us.
Goodbye, everyone.
See you next time.